Blog Talk Radio.
Down to that union hall. We're gonna romp and tromp till midnight. We're gonna fuss and fight till daylight. We gon' pitch a swing, swing, doodle all night long. All night long. All night long. All night long. Tell Hooter across the ridge. Tell Albert, see your Ned. Tell old Pistol Pete. Everybody gon' meet. Tonight we need no rest. We're really gonna throw on a mess. We're gonna break out all the windows. We're gonna kick down all the doors. We gon' pitch a swing, swing, do all night long. 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 We got sawdust on the floor. Tell Tiggin' and tell I die. Who's going to have a time? When the beach can fill the air, I mean, snuff juice everywhere. We gon' pitch a swing, swing, swing.
Welcome to Your Mother's Medicine Cabinet. We're on a special night tonight because last night I was watching football. Just a little word about next week. Our guest will be Australian writer Amanda Joy. Hopefully get her on the show. She said she would. And that was Wang Dang Duel by Holly Wolf. But tonight we have welcoming back our first guest, Will Crawford, in his new book, Actual Tigers. He was our first guest of the show last April, so I think this is him online now, so let's just bring him on. Will?
Aside from the obvious, what's the difference between a living writer and a dead writer?
What?
The dead one cannot improve.
Yes.
That's it. Doesn't take a professor from Actual Tigers. It's probably the shortest piece I put in that book.
Yeah, the short pieces are cool sometimes, like if you can say a lot there. So how's life out in Philadelphia?
Well, I'm stable. You know, I'm trying not to bring the landscape home with me, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
but McNutley is profoundly grateful for the Howlin' Wolf. He loves the blues to the chagrin of Mama Sass, who's more into Japanese New Age these days, or on a timeshare with the stereo. So he's really full of himself now since you played that, because he beat me in a game of toss across, last minute game of toss across right before I called in.
did he look up at the phone or the computer when he heard the wang dang doodle and start to jump around?
Well, the whole family's up there listening to the show in the penthouse suite up there where the chinchilla and the rabbit hang out most of the time, and Kim's up there listening in. She just gave me the thumbs up, so I guess I'm coming across somewhat clearly here.
So what's the what is Japanese New Wave music?
Japanese New Age, and did I call it New Wave? Sass is really going to be upset with me for that. It's like it's really trippy stuff, man. I feel like I'm on a peyote or something when I hear it playing up there. But she loves it, and that and Andes, like flute music. Of all chinchillas are from the Andes, so naturally she enjoys that. But for McNutley, it's tantamount to aural flagellation. He can't stand that stuff. He loves the blues.
That's cool. So last time that we talked, I believe that your book was like in the process of coming out, and now it's been out since what, like October-ish? Halloween?
Yeah, they released it. It was released earlier than that, and the primary reason for that is my publishers gave me a tremendous vote of confidence and wanted to put it into contention for the Pulitzer. Now, it's not a nomination. A nomination is when you're a finalist for the Pulitzer, but it's in contention, at least. They sent a book to the Pulitzer people with powdered wigs or whatever, and they're going to check it out, and we'll see if anything comes of that. But I think it's a tremendous vote of confidence. I'm really pleased with the press I'm with right now, and they value artistry over avarice, and they've been an absolute dream to work with on this book, which is bound by heart and soul ties. So, really comfortable relationship with the girls over there, and they're actual poets too, so that always helps.
Yeah, that's definitely cool. So how's the book been coming along? Like, are you getting out there? Are you going to read places, or are you just sitting back?
I'll tell you, I've become so introverted as I've grown older. I'm ready to hit 40 soon, and I like reading this way. I like sitting on my couch in pajamas with my cat behind me with Fargo playing in the background as a sort of homage to you. And if I could bring my couch and my cat with me and the pajamas to readings, I'd probably do more of them. Philadelphia is a kind of a dead scene. There's a lot of slam poetry in Philadelphia, which to me is all ego and zero substance. I don't want to get involved in doing a reading with slam poetry. And you told me a funny story once about a slam poetry reading you attended. I think I saw a picture of you from there where you're like giving like the devil's horns and celebrating over like a 32-ounce lager or something. I think Aaron sent me that picture, the other white reared.
Yeah, that was... I've had some, it was in Providence, Rhode Island. I went to a poetry reading that I thought was a poetry reading, and then there was all this like performance and hand gesturing, and I don't know what it was, but I didn't like it. And they had like names like Pooh McIce, performance poet or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's, to me, for Philadelphia, if you don't have an agent or a publicist, you don't get too far. My publicist is a chinchilla, and my agent's a rabbit, so you know, just got to make do with what I can. They don't take too much of a percentage. They're not taking 12% of the 20% I make or anything like that. I could at least feed those guys. And actual Tigers have come along fairly well. I mean, I hear it went aluminum faster than fire in the marrow, and nominated for a People's Book Prize in the UK, and my publishers also put it up for a pushcart prize. So I've got a little bit of a triple Lindy thing happening here right now.
Nice, nice. That's not too bad. So why don't you give us a piece from the book, and we'll take it from there.
All right, let me read another short piece. Read Gravitas, which was first published by Edgar and Lenore's Publishing House on the Edgar Allan Poets site. And... I can hear. All right, it's on the blackjack page. That's right. Gravitas. Challenger is all gamble, no spark, when he bets on knight with slender means. He has convinced himself that the question holds more weight than the answer, as he fashions a knife from poached ivory, all blade, no handle. He sees blood on his hands and feels proud. Day arrives as expected, every hour brighter now. His blood, a half-baked cake, wishing to be a candle. All of this friction without flame.
Nice. So, just to sway from the poetry for a second, you did a little poetry thing on for a classroom the other day, did you not? Diana Rose?
Yeah. In a
classroom?
No, I did that. It was a sixth grade class, and I found it really gratifying, and it was for Diana Rose. She asked me to do it, and I have such a high, I hold her in such high regard, and she does so much for living writers. And I've been on her show a couple of times. And normally I've respectfully declined to talk to classrooms because I don't think you find a gift there most of the time. I think it finds you. And there's the workshop. I think workshops are kind of killing poetry these days. And I think poetry is something that you learn to hone that craft by spending a lot of time alone and in solitude. And there's a certain lonely ecstasy to it. But this time I did, and I really enjoyed it. I read one poem for them, Recognizing the Fragile Before It Needs Fixing. I thought that went pretty well with the season, and they asked some great questions, and it was a pretty good time. It took like 15 or 20 minutes, probably the best thing I've done over the phone in ages. And it was
That's
just
cool,
nice hearing them all say thank you and everything. It was really cool, you know, and it was something I couldn't really see myself doing, and I decided to do it, and I'm glad I did it.
Yeah, and you turned me on to the younger Franz, the younger Wright, Franz, and you touched on something that he said a minute ago and that I agree about with workshops, that he had that rant, but I guess his page has vanished, but that he said all these workshops and master's degrees creating people that are 24 years old that think they're Hart Crane or whoever, and care to elaborate, like, is that what you mean by the workshops?
Yeah, I just think that it there's a generic kind of writing that comes out of it, and I think you really have to spend a lot of time alone. You have to put down your gadgets and go out in the nature and observe animals, and to me all the simple answers to our complex questions are out in nature and in animals, and to me a rabbit yawning or a cat stretching in a spot of sun teaches me more about poetry than any book ever has. And I've spent so much time alone. I've been writing since I was about 8 years old. I started writing stories, and when I was 11, I started writing poems. And I waited to get published until I was about 33, and even then it took people telling me, you got to get your work out there, and pushing me out there to do it. And Franz has been great. He's given me feedback on my work, and he's the kind of guy that will give you an honest critique, but it will be constructive. He's not going to dwell on a line break. He's going to give you honest and really, really useful feedback, And he's the sweetest guy, too. He sends me messages, and he's a great guy, but his rants really inspire me, and I think he's spot on with an awful lot of them. And it's good that a poet that has some substance like him was able to pull a Pulitzer Prize. I think the only other poet that I've read that won a Pulitzer in recent times I kind of enjoy, even though he's more of an academic poet, is Stephen Dunn. I think he won one back in 91. But, found out about Franz's work initially because I was published in a journal that he was in. It was a whole issue that was pretty much dedicated to him, where he had several pieces and one of the greatest interviews I ever read. And I had a piece called Sunspots, a very personal piece that was included in that issue. And Zoe Guillerme, one of the publishers there, one of the editors, thought that it would complement Franz's work well. And Franz messaged me and said some really nice things about the piece. And I told him how much I enjoyed the interview and the pieces they published by him. And ever since then, we've had a little bit of a correspondence going.
That's cool. Yeah, like, I guess, when he spoke that, like, I find a lot of truth in that. It's nice to hear I wouldn't really call him an academic, but somebody who, like, has won an award such as that to say the things he said that, like, so many of the, I don't like to use the word small press either, but, you know, poets with substance are, can't say because they don't have that voice yet. But he's won that Pulitzer, and it's nice that, you know, he speaks out against the Billy Collins and the cronies of the world.
Yeah, I think it's commendable. And I just think that especially in the world of the big presses, the mainstream presses, you need that degree right now to really get in. There's like a literati Illuminati thing going on. If you have that piece of paper that you paid money to get and you learn to be a writer there and it says that on a piece of paper, then you're freely accepted for publishing. And most of those guys win the awards now and those girls win the awards now. Whereas you got a lot of self-taught people in the smaller presses, and I think they're skinning their hearts and they're putting some really true art out there, and they go largely ignored, especially in the commercial realm. I mean, critically, they can do very well, and they could receive praise on their work, but a lot of the doors are closed because the guidelines for submitting work right now with the major presses, it's all geared towards agents more so than writers. And I just think that's a miscarriage of justice in and of itself. But, yeah, if you're an academic writer right now, then you're in. You know, that's they're for you. And it really is like an Illuminati-type setup to me, or maybe I'm just thinking too deeply on it, and I promise I wouldn't get too negative. I'm trying to challenge.
No, I'm not trying to be negative. I think it's an interesting topic, but to like to bury this subject, like I think of like I could turn around and look at my bookcase, and even if they did go to college, a majority of them didn't even like study like writing of some kind in college. They studied something else, or they were college dropouts, or they didn't go to college at all. Like you know, and it's not to like bust on education, but I agree with you. Poetry is, I think I had George Wallace on a few weeks ago, and he said something like, poetry's meant to run through the woods with your shirt off, where you're screaming at the top of your lungs, and I thought that was a good way to put it. But
it has a wild and free spirit and shouldn't be trapped inside a stuffy classroom with dim lighting that sort of thing. But I dropped out of college, too. I was majoring in psychology while I was there. And there is a sort of psychological slant to some of the things I write, I guess. But
yes.
I don't know. I think sometimes it's forgotten that most of the great artists were self-taught.
And lastly, yeah, solitude is a thing that most miss out on. Like myself being in the Badlands for the past 3.5 years has been nothing but solitude, and some of my best stuff has come out of that solitude. And it's not even always loneliness, because you could have joy and happiness in solitude just as much as you can loneliness. You know, that's the misconception, that solitude brings loneliness. And it does.
No, to me, it brings quite a bit of bliss. That's I enjoy it immensely. Yeah, but I live with my wife, and she's my best friend, so I'm not really truly ever alone. There's a difference between isolation and solitude, and I have all this great energy from the animals that are around me here too.
No,
I have a wonderful music collection, all that good stuff.
No, I have all that stuff too. I understand, but like it's. I don't know, the misconception. But anyways, why don't you give us another poem from the book?
Yeah, I was prepared to read a new poem I wrote recently. It's not in the book, but I'll get back to the book and read a couple pieces from that too. But I want to read this one.
Okay.
It kind of goes,
is this a new one?
Yeah, it's a newer one.
Okay.
And it's called Just Remembering. Just Remembering, which reminds me just how much I miss the days of whistle solos and stay-home telephones. Those sunlight strained through silk radiant days when my mother smelled like the beach, even if we were 133 miles away from one. I miss the lonesome soft-eyed widow, too, playing her Christmas records in June from the row home next to ours. I miss the Action News weatherman telling me from the rabbit-eared TV that my Catholic school was closed due to snow. Ice ball fights in igloo fortresses. Go out long football on the field behind the church with a hypodermic steeple. Mock speed sledding down the hills of the Indian name golf course. Hot cocoa from a thermos that smelled like a year's worth of soup. I miss the naturally beautiful starlet who left something to the imagination, and jazz being called the great American art form. I miss the days when readers outnumbered writers, and those writers remembered to leave something for the imagination, as they wrote their original stories, poems, plays, and prayers, without ever writing a word about writing. I miss the days when mystery and pause were observed and respected. Time had deeper pockets then. We picked them for the riches. I miss the change time had to spare.
Nice, man. So is there a backstory? I mean, obviously I understand the story, but is there a backstory that inspired that? Did you happen to hear a whistle?
I miss the simplicity of youth. It's just so much to deal with in this adult life, and it's a... The vicissitudes can be so much at times, and it's good to have a release like writing to fall back on, and I try to write every day. And I was just thinking of a simpler time there.
Yeah, the igloo forts, man. Snowball fights, going deep.
Go out long.
I remember all that stuff, man.
I think the Patriots were doing that last night. Go out long, man. They look damn good. No, they may be the best team in the league. I'm sold now. The defense looked amazing last night.
Yeah, I was.
They
good,
knocked the
man.
Thunder and Lagomorphs out of the playoffs, man. Four players knocked us out.
But it was because of the New England Patriots. I was down till last night. It was funny. I was surrounded. Me and April went out to watch it. It was worthy of big screen watching. So, and when it was like me and her, and about 15 Texans fans. I don't know how the Houston, people from Houston got up here, but it was pretty funny. So,
of all places
anyhow,
to make a pilgrimage to, they go to Minot.
Yeah,
hey,
man, we're trying to get out of here. So, hopefully, that will happen in 2013. But anyhow, so how did you hook up with the press you're with now? Why don't you talk about your press a little bit?
Yeah, I had a few options on presses to go with the manuscript, and I decided on them because I felt really comfortable, especially dealing with April Skies, and Alicia's been great too, Alicia Winsky. But I had a few pieces published there, and April had been in contact with me telling me that she really enjoyed my work, and I felt a connection to it, and I said, well, how about I send you this manuscript and tell me what you think? And a couple days later, she replied to me, and she loved it, and she wanted to publish it. And I said, "Well, you've got it. I'll send it to you. I'll send you the rest, and let's do a book together." And I love the way it unfolded after that. It's been a great relationship with that press, and I have good things coming too. They have an anthology coming out later this month, "Men in the Company of Women," that I'll have three pieces in, and there's a host of outstanding living writers that will be included in that anthology, like E.L. Freifeld and A. Razor. Angel Perales will be in there, and many others, like 50 writers. So I'm looking forward to being included in that project.
That's cool, man. Yeah, that's I think I heard about that. I think I've been hearing about that a lot. Or is it, did they do another one? It was called "Just in the Company of Women," just women.
Yeah, and there's so many great living women writers were in that. You had April was in that, April Bratton, and Barbara Moore, and so many that I admire immensely. I think Jackie Corcoran was in that anthology.
She backed out of doing the show. She was my guest originally slated a week or so ago. It's too bad. I was looking forward to getting her on the show, Jackie Corcoran.
How many shows have you done so far?
Jesus, man. Since your show, like, what was it, like April 1st or 3rd or something of last year, of this year,
yeah.
I've done one.
Day.
Yeah, I've done one every Monday except for like 2 or 3 days. Like one day I was in San Francisco, I didn't do it. And yesterday I didn't do one. And there was like another day that someone canceled out on me, but the show's going up through March, and then I'm putting an end to it. Enough of radio shows and radio personalities, but it was my way of giving back to the muse, because I have no other really way to do it. Like, you know, I'll buy books when I can from writers I like, but I guess, I don't know, just a way of giving back.
Yeah, I think it's noble. I still have to buy the Bratton's latest book. Still have to get a copy of that. That's essential. I think it's cover art of the year. I love the cover art for that book.
Yeah, some good artwork. It's a good book. I've read it. It's actually outstanding, and I've read it. Sometimes, like, you just, like, it brings you such joy to, like, you know, be a door away from that talent, but yet at the same time, you're like, damn it. Like, you know, it's
really,
it's
she
good.
Can really tell a story with a short poem. She packs, I've said it before, she packs more emotion into a poem, just more raw emotion than most novelists could fit into like 2 or 3 novels. It's amazing what she does with words. One of my absolute favorite writers.
Yeah, it seems like, I don't know, the older, like, because you're approaching 40, I'm approaching 39, and it's just like, it's almost that midlife point, and like, the writing is like, I know for most people that hit this age, it takes a different turn in a way. Do you see that happening with you, like growing more, turning?
Yeah, I would like to get back to writing short stories more. I think that there's just more freedom in that, and I feel somewhat limited by poems. I'm not even sure I want to do another book of poetry now, even though I have a manuscript of ekphrastic pieces I was thinking about submitting to a couple different presses. But I'm not sure I want to do that. I kind of want to do a collection of short stories and then some screenplays and maybe even start working on a novel or something. I don't know.
You know, I mean, it's all writing. You can always, like do it. Like, when I finish this book for A. Razor that's coming out next year, which is done, I just got to do the painstaking, boring part of picking the poems. It's kind of like I want to do some prose, but I know the poems are still going to slip out from time to time. There's no way to stop them, you know, and I don't think you should stop them. I don't know.
Just let the pen take the hand, and what comes out, and
yeah.
I don't have too much control over it. I sometimes will start with what's to me a great and simple image or something and build around it, but there are times I'll write something out and I barely remember any of it, and I can go back and judge it objectively and edit it. You know, and I like to edit the images in my head before they ever hit the page if I can. And I think we have to work on editing our images and our metaphors, not just line breaks and the structure of poems. I think it goes deeper than that. We've discussed that before, and yeah, there is a maturation that comes with growing older, and I think that you return to simplicity a little bit. I read some really word-heavy poems I wrote when I was younger, and they make me cringe, man. And the images are just out of control, and there's too many images. It's like it's too much to take, and I wonder what I could have been thinking, why I didn't spend some time editing those poems.
Yeah, I totally agree with you that it seems to be like like when you're talking about nature, when you're in like nature, like when I'm walking out there or if someone's walking out there and like you see something like pretty flower, and it's just like it's so simple that you want your words to like describe it as something simple instead of this like manifesto on like on the flower. It gets to be, I don't know, like, I don't know if you become a crotchety old man about it, but you just want it to be simple, kind of like Lee Poe. He just didn't give a damn. There was like, you know, here are my 8 lines about a freaking mountain, and 8 lines is all you ever needed about it. I don't know. That's kind of how I see my turn, but simplicity, yeah, it's definitely like your poem stated, those easier days, but we can never, like, go back, you know. We can only visit them in memory, I guess.
Lee Poe, that's for sure. I love me some Lee Poe, and I like what you're doing. Your writing has sort of a zen thing to it these days, and I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the shorter pieces you've been doing.
Yeah, it's kind of like a contrast between of there's Henry being my middle name, and then there's Frank, and it's like a, there's like, instead of being like, how you said, like, images, like I was there at one time with all these crazy images, and now it's like a battle between these two freaking people, and I'm hoping one, just Frank, just comes out at the end, because I see writing as a journey and art of life in a way, you know. I don't see it just as, you know, it's just as something you do, like, you know, as your life changes, so does the writing, I think.
Yeah, I think anyone who's been writing a long time, like you have or I have, understand that it is more about a journey than anything else, and it's bigger than you are. I think it's a bigger thing, and that's why there really shouldn't be much ego in it. And to me,
I'm
grateful that I can do it, and it's something that's larger than me, and it's something that I've just started to understand, I believe, and I don't think I'll ever fully understand it, and the poems are still revealing new things to me that I've written, and
I think the more solitude you take, the more understanding you take of those simpler things and those transitions. I think those are the, but sometimes I just need to get the hell out, you know, and like, but anyway, so why don't you give us another poem, whatever one you want, new or from the book, it doesn't matter.
I'll give a reading from Actual Tigers. This is where the book ends, and The Depths of Something Good is the title. Mama cut her tongue loose while the frame lost its edges in that balmy harbor bar. Clifford held his own. Knew it was sometimes best to just listen when a woman was speaking. She was drunk and talking about the day of his birth. The womb couldn't be abstracted in this form, though the form was hardly concrete either. You didn't want out of there, she said, before ordering another sherry. Clifford thought of his knifed palate, the guts beneath his bloodied canvas, flash brews of color, texture, and image fused into raw living spirit, human brushing divine, jungle fires in reverse, the deep blue toll of harbor bells, a new language, sailors singing salty shanties of strumpets, sirens, and shipwrecks, torn sky of oil. It had been raining hard bop jazz all day, she said, while flagging the waitress for more sherry. Clifford thought of a deep red umbrella, but it was more a sound than an object. Luscious wind going wild in a tree wished to climb. Patience dripped its port wine stain down onto his high forehead. He supposed that's where he first learned it. Virtuous patience, as the folks say, 9 months of training. Outside, the old pier was creaking, as old piers are wont to. You didn't even cry when you arrived. The doctor said boys about as animated as Rushmore. She just kept on going with a recurring sherry, her fistful of ugly oyster crackers dipped in horseradish. He loved her for it. He laughed with his eyes. It felt better that way. Later, he'd paint her, all of her. Scent, sight, sound, spittle spray, the whole human. He doubted she'd even recognize herself. But he knew he'd find himself as a child again inside of her. Found, lost, found again, in the depths of something good. He said that to himself. He sounded like his mother.
Nice, man. These are like some great pieces. This is a book I'd like to own that I've read through the PDF file that you had sent me, the file long ago that I blurbed for you. And anybody who's listening, and I know there's listeners, if you want to call in, you can, but this is definitely a book you should pick up. It's one of the better ones that I've read this year. And it's funny, it's because I was in this magazine recently, and they asked me a question like my 10 favorite books, and I think like 3 or 4 of them were by like dead people, but like a majority of them were by living people. Because all these, like, since we've all, like, known each other here and there by name or actual meeting for the past, like, 6 or 7 years, some of these people have grown into, like, flourished into outstanding writers. And now I understand what people like Celine, like, went through. Like, you know, like, the madness he went through, like, just living this, like, dirt poor existence, you know, like, but doing what he loved. And I don't think of it as dirt poor. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that? Or I think it's enriching, to be honest with you.
Yeah, D.C. Berman wrote in one of his songs, poor as a mouse in the morning, rich as a cat every night. And I think that's maybe the life of the artist. I think of the painters, too, like Van Gogh, who sold, I think, one painting during his lifetime, and that was painting sell for about $20 million each. Celine, look what he did. He just wrote one of the greatest novels ever written, and Journey to the End of the Night. I put that up there in my top 10, along with Fonte the Elder's Ask the Dust. You know, neither guy, that Fonte the Elder was a blue-collar guy. He was just week-to-week with paychecks until he went out to Hollywood and started doing some screenwriting and stuff. And that one of my favorite shows you had, I just want to bring this up since I brought up Fonte the Elder, was with Fonte the Younger, Dan Fonte. I really enjoyed that show. And that and the other White Reardon show, I thought was phenomenal with those callers from Lynn Mass and the Streetwalker callers and everything. That was hilarious. And good Poe, too. Worked on both levels.
Yeah, that was an honor for me to do that Dan show. And he was like kind of like, I guess, what Franz was for you. Like, I mean, I don't talk to him all the time, but, like, once in a great while, like, I send an email, and for him to blurb my book, my next two books, made me feel great. That show, like, learned a lot. And if you get a chance, if you haven't already, you should read his memoir, Fonte, A Life of Drinking and Family or something like that. It's, like, one of the best memoirs.
I haven't read that memoir.
Yeah, it's, like, one of the best things I've ever read. And they've had these, like outstanding photographs in it too of like the Fonte family that you've never really seen before, and it was pretty outstanding. I think he's one of the
they're American for sure.
Yeah, like him and Franz are probably the only like bigger, more well known ones that I know that are like doing it right still. I mean, I'm sure there's others, but I mean that I've known, like, you know, like no one's banging down my door for movies. It's like, you know, the only thing that's banging in my house is the rabbit's leg for freaking crazins.
Yeah, which you compared to a crack addiction. That's perfect. That's exactly what it's like, man. He becomes a fiend as soon as I pull out the crazins, McNulty. And we found these really big, juicy ones for him that Kim buys from Rite Aid. And he goes wild for those things. He starts doing flips and everything. And got to keep the rabbit fed. But back to what you were saying, I think it's really important to know the struggle. And I think a lot of great art comes from the struggle, and that fuels creativity. And I sure as hell can't write when I'm feeling violently happy. Something I've learned to do in solitude when I was feeling particularly low most of the time, and just it helped me to get by. And I'm not saying it's a kind of therapy, because it's not that at all. It's just something that feels good. I still love that finite rush that comes from creating something from scratch. And it's one of the best feelings I know, that ability to feel weightless, if even only for a moment or two. I think it's so worth it just to get feeling of weightlessness.
When you touched on that as therapy, I think, like, when you write, when you want to call it, quote-unquote, therapy, I think it becomes like a diary writing of sorts. Like, it's not like poetry or short story so much. I think it's important to write about the past so you can get to that. I like to call it like that Frank O'Hara state where everything's like in the present, you know, like, cause he wrote in the present most of the time. And to become the person that you are at that present. But of course we're going to be, we could have this conversation when we're 50 and look back when we're 40, and, you know, just it's always like this evolving thing, but you can't evolve as the writer till you write out the past, I think, in many ways, you know. So I that's why I like the cover of your book. So tell us about the cover of the book.
That's my favorite photograph of all time. It was taken by my maternal grandmother, Grace Painter. And it's my mother holding the folk guitar there, and my Aunt Cookie, my favorite aunt next to her sister, and it was taken on Halloween of 1964 in a Sunray drugstore on Broad Street right here in Philadelphia. And to me, those two ladies are actual tigers. They survived so much in their childhood, and they really came out on top, and they just have such spirit, such emotional honesty and humor, and they're wonderful. I'm related to them. It's a wonderful thing to have women like that in your life, and I have these strong women in my life with very high self-esteem, and I love being around them. And I, you know, Kim's like that too, and Kim has become best friends of my mother now, and that friendship is a wonderful thing to observe and to have in your life. It brings a lot of light into life. But it was a pleasure to put those ladies on the cover like that, and my mother loves it, and Cookie loves it, so it's a good thing.
Well, hell, I mean, no, it is a cool picture. It's, yeah, so why don't you tell everybody, we'll get this stuff out of the way that I do every show. Why don't you tell everybody how to get any of the poetry books that you've put out?
They're available all over the place. I just found out that they're selling them at Powell's now too. But Amazon, I guess, is a good place to get one. You could go to Barnes and Noble, or you could buy one. You can go to the Edgar Allan Poets site, which has a page up for actual tigers, and you could request a signed copy there with PayPal. You could always message me if you want a signed copy and you don't like using PayPal and you want to just send a check or a money order, cold cash. I'm even offering a bundle deal with a few copies I have left of Fire in the Marrow, where I'll send actual tigers and Fire in the Marrow out. And Fire in the Marrow is still in print and still for sale at all those places I mentioned, except for the Edgar Allan Poets site, of course. But you can get that through Neopoesis and the publisher for that book. It was also a pleasure working with those guys as well. So it's been nice to have two books from two different presses with people whom I admire and enjoyed working with.
Yeah, it was. It's a good thing at working with a publisher that believes in what you do, you know, because there's so many out there that just like throw things together, like, you know, because it's a painstaking process after the art is done, because you got to work with the publisher to pick things out and to go through certain edits, and no matter what, any young writers out there that are listening, edits are important. Commas where they go sometimes are important. So I think it's important, and it's obvious that I've also, of course, worked with Neopoesis on two books, so as you have with one, and they're a joy to work with, and I'm sure that your new ones are a joy to work with, so that's always a bonus to have that, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So why don't you read us another... What?
Yeah, I was going to say I'd like to read. This was requested, and this is the first time I'm reading this one aloud, because it's still very fresh inside me, and it's a true story, and it's something I went through when I was younger, and I'm going to read it. Venus Flytrap recently did a reading of this, and I was really touched by it. Hank at the Strangler Bukema read this, made a little video to help promote actual tigers, and he's been wonderful with that. Like every day, he's saying something nice about actual tigers, so I appreciate Hank and what he's about. And this is called Sunspots. It's for Katarina. She told me that she first felt a cancer inside of her when she laughed. She said the tumors looked like sunspots when x-rayed. When I heard that, I felt a breakage all the way down deep inside. Yet somehow her eyes still smiled. When we kissed, I could taste her sickness. One night I commented on her naked body while we were making love. I said, even your scars seem luminous to my eyes. She thought I said stars. It was true, you know. Could have looked at her for 500 more years, and every time she'd still seem new to me. I've kept a cassette tape she gave me for my 17th birthday, weightless recordings of Katarina playing violin for a room full of family and their friends. She was just a child. Young life fingers a deft ballet across the slender neck of that sad old instrument. Music never cries, it simply says I'm alive. The tape is worn thin, it hisses now. Not like a snake, but rather an easy zephyr through the trees when they are full. I keep an old cassette deck out in my van. Sometimes I just drive in circles around the neighborhood where she lived and listen to what she has to say as she breaks to be beautiful, as her grace disrupts the disorder of my day.
Wow, man. That was pretty heavy. That's like, sort of kind of like broke my heart a bit.
Yeah, that was first included in that Franz Wright issue of Triggerfish I alluded to earlier. And the first time I think I've read that one out loud. I sometimes will read poems aloud to Kim. This is she makes for a perfect critic to have to live with you. She gives a great feedback on things that I write. And I don't even think I've read that one out loud to her. And I thanked Hank for reading it because I could never bring myself to read it. But I made it through that one. But, yeah, it's still a fresh wound to me. And hopefully that helps gauze a little bit that I finally was able to read it out loud like that.
Yeah, but you're able to, like, you know, I think sometimes you're able to, like, face those things. And you're able to write about them. It's the best we can do as humans, you know.
Yeah.
It's either that or spend $1 million on therapists. You know, so.
Plus, I didn't want to. Yeah, therapy. What a racket that is. Yeah. It's, I think there was a. Duchovny said something funny on an episode of Californication. He said, "Therapy, I'm a writer. I don't give that shit away for free." That was pretty good.
Yeah, it is a racket. I learned that the hard way. But anyways, so it's, yeah, so. You're going to be doing, in the future, you're going to be doing some prose. You got, like, ideas? Are you starting to work on that, or are you just, like, taking a break?
A lot of the short stories I've written, for some reason, are Southern Gothic-type stories, even though I grew up mostly in the North and the Northeast. I've always loved that sort of subgenre of writing, the Southern Gothic stuff, the movies that David Gordon Green has done, like Snow Angels, for instance, that one of the most visceral performances I've ever seen by an actor, Sam Rockwell, in that. And, they're kind of displaced Southern Gothic since I'm up here in Philadelphia writing them, but I find them really gratifying to write, and a lot of it has to do with the substance and mood of the pieces. But,
so
the prose is finding its way into a lot of my poems, too, though, and I've been writing a lot of what I call proems, like that Joe Frazier piece you loved from Actual Tigers. That's more of a proem, and I just didn't want to repeat any pieces I read on the last episode, so I'm not going to read the Frazier piece tonight or the Coltrane piece, and those are two of the pieces I get a lot of great feedback about from Actual Tigers, but I'm going to skip this tonight.
Yeah, so if you want to hear the Joe Frazier poem, listeners, you can go to the archive to last April, look for Will's other show, and it will be there. But, yeah, those are sometimes those prose poems are... Just like you were talking earlier about how when you were younger and you go back and you know, all the images and stuff, sometimes those prose poems, I think, help control those images. It keeps it in a story, but you still got to find the poetry in there, kind of like old William Carlos Williams, you know, wrote a lot of them prose ones, but there'd always be that one or two, three-year freaking lines in there that made it a poem that was surrounded by the prose, and I'm a big fan of the proems, as you call them.
Yeah, I am too. You get a little more freedom with them. You could incorporate some humor into them, which is sorely missing in most poetry these days. I'd like to read a poem that you wrote that was in your Interstate Chokehold book that I really love. And I love it because all the things I think are great about a poem are in it. And it has the mind's eye view of self, and it's a really sharp view. It has tons of emotional honesty.
All right, go for it.
I feel like I'm being edified and eviscerated concomitantly every time I read it to myself, so I want to read this one out loud. It's Steel Guitar Songs for April. Into the straight planes of those eyes is Big Joe Turner breaking my heart, and she assumes my advances are fake. I've kicked humor with a broken mule. I've typed midnight messages all the way to Minot, but she responds with a rubber chicken and some kind of foul grin that could kill the High Plains Drifter. I want to slide down that blonde with a whimsical duty that only a pirate would understand. But she turns off nighttime with a kiss to the sky, and I somehow feel the metal grip my mind just a little harder. I imagine denim fraying around her white feet, light paint chipping as she tries to read what I wrote the night before. More than likely, I was drunk, looking in the pools of brown that would make a Western shirt run for cover. So instead, I write and try to capture her imagination with my salivating keys, hoping her smile will break my spine.
Oh, thanks for reading that. It's weird to hear, like, some of the poems you wrote, like, so long ago. I must have wrote that 4 years ago, or maybe even, you know, 4 years ago. And it's weird to hear that because, like, it brings you back to a time when you actually wrote it.
it was weird. It was just before I was like, I think it was either when I first got here or when I was on my way here. So it's a lot of, it makes me feel like a young man, even though I was like 34, you know, I don't know.
Brings it all back home.
Yeah, it does. It's, these love poems are, I think are an important part of poetry, but the problem with love poems is 90% of them are just sappy, you know, like, and they don't sound right to me. Like, you know, it sounds like a diary entry. So it's hard to write like a really good love poem, like, you know, or you'll start like writing love poems like Pablo Neruda about your socks. Like, you know,
you don't
like,
want to do that. That's, there's stuff I really love by Neruda, but that's that socks thing. That's not one of them. I like writing a good love poem, and it doesn't have to be you don't have to be too obvious with it. I mean, there's plenty of ways to write a love poem. I could read one that I wrote recently called Spiders Are Creative Now, and I consider this a love poem. It was definitely inspired by Kim Schlegel, my wife, and I'll read it.
Right, go for it.
Spiders are creative. Don't bring the landscape home with you tonight, she said, as she rubbed her eyes until sleep turned into light. I thought of autumn, deep brown and naked, inviting itself into our home. A dark, early woman, a little dangerous in the eyes, raw-boned and ready to share the warmth of our bed. She'd never go for that Three's Company crowded business, nor would I. Autumn was too lean, too stark to sustain our fire, too shaky to measure the grievous seasons of rain and brief miracles we shared by hand. We shut it off, chip paint shutters pale blue, locked over paned windows wheezing. We shuddered with them, then let go, realizing the light and shadow between our skin was company enough. Secretly keeping dry kindling in a kingdom of rain was our crime. Autumn rapped on the door, eyed the weary peephole, blew on her whistle, served us her slight paper sound. A hungry brown spider weaving, testing the resiliency of her own silk, before swallowing something whole, or perhaps losing it entirely. She placed an ear to the door and listened, returned and softly slipped back into bed. I like spiders, they're creative, she said, before merging her body with mine. Rising and falling tongues of raw fire eschewing words, knowing the common silence was enough of a share, and that the silk would hold us together for at least another season.
Nice, man. Yeah, see, it's not like, it's not obvious, it's not like, he came to me with roses and love at my feet, like, it's not like... That's what I mean. Like, a love poem can be like really, I mean, love is an emotion just like anything else, and it should be written about, but I think it's a little bit, I think it's a little more challenging, unless of course you're a Wanberg or a Walt Whitman, where like there's just, for some reason, there's no plate of metal to pen it. Like, it just comes out, like, you know, there's no buffer, and you know, that's a dude I miss a lot. I miss his words.
Wanberg, yeah. He's the kind of guy you would be talking to him about your rabbit, and 10 minutes later he would be messaging you a quick poem he wrote about the rabbit, and it was a wonderful poem. I mean, it wasn't like a knockoff or something. It was real.
And you could do it, like, within seconds, and that's what, it's like almost like so envious that, like, and he didn't care if he didn't shut it off, like, you know, and I loved that about him. Like, he just wanted it to always be open. He was always aware. And it was great that, like, people are, you know, I got to know him the last few years of his life. I was happy that, like, he blurbed my first book, and I was happy to meet with him and read with him. It was truly like a joy. I miss that dude. He was a good guy, man.
He was a genuine article for sure, and it's an absolute pleasure to have his name on the back of Fire in the Marrow. He wrote a wonderful blurb for that. He had that blurb done in about 15 minutes and had so much substance. I said, take a couple weeks, whatever you need. I don't need it right away. And 15 minutes later, I have this really well-written blurb from Scott Wanberg. I'm like, Jesus, cuckoo Christ, this guy can just write it. It's always on. It's always flowing out of this guy.
And it never stopped, and that was, like, truly a gift. I think they dedicated in the Huntington Library in L.A., the famous library where they have, like, all the, like, Bukowski stuff set up and stuff, like his typewriter and all that. They named the library, like, the Scott Wanberg Library Reading Room or something like that. I mean, that's how, like, influential he was to people. which shows, you know, and yeah, he was a. That's pretty awesome, man. Walk into the Scott Longbird Library to see Pekowski's typewriter. So that's just a lot
about
a person.
That work's always alive. Yeah, that work is that'll always have life in it. There's so much life in his work that the spirit will always be around us and it will rise and surround us quite often whenever you read his work.
It took me forever to realize that Sparky wasn't a real dog, though.
And I wanna. We talked a lot about prose pieces and proems and all that stuff, and I wrote a. It's longer, and I think we have about 10 minutes, so I should be able to fit it in, and maybe we won't be able to talk anymore about writing. And I'd rather do it than talk about it anyway. You know how I am, and this is a longer piece, but I wrote it for my maternal grandfather, Poe Painter, and I really wish that I put it in actual Tigers. It would have been a perfect fit in the book. But I didn't, so I just I have it now, and I'd like to read this. Another one I don't think I've ever read out loud before. So if you're ready for it, I'll read it.
Yeah, go for it, man.
All right, it's called Jesus Cuckoo Christ. That was one of his one-liners, so you would say that quite a bit. He was overwhelmed by something, usually. And this is for Poe, not the Raven one, this one. Grandpa Poe moved in with us the summer after Grandma Grace died and brought his best effects with him. A bedside table with drawers almost too heavy to open. Every issue of Playboy from 1969 through 1983. $100 worth of bicentennial quarters. Rubber-banded stacks of Raleigh cigarette coupons and Old Spice proofs of purchase all packed inside. A massive wooden wardrobe where he kept his old army uniforms, American flag, a rainbow of button-up big-collared polyester shirts, sleek Bob Barker suits that had $100 bills tucked into pockets. He kept his old knife and gun collection rolled up and secreted inside reams of threadbare jaundiced underwear, fully knowing no one would dare to touch. My parents gave him the catbird seat in our Port Richmond row home, a front bedroom with expansive vistas of the Polish ballroom and its gravel parking lot. It allowed him to ogle hot middle-aged women at night and watch our daily wiffle ball games during the day. I would wait along with my little brother Michael and best friend Fiend Corey, whom Poe hated, for the old man to make one of several jaunts down to his favorite bar, the Cases Altered, for six packs of Ortlieb's Pounders. While Poe was away, we'd pick the locked door with one of my mother's bobby pins and step all over one another to get inside. The room had the rich, ripened odor of Poe himself, an olfactory assault of tobacco, cheap beer, Old Spice, and a faint suggestion of lingering flatulence. In a manner of tongue to bad tooth, we were drawn to that sacred Playboy drawer, and within seconds we'd have glossy issues spread-eagled on the floor, a scotch-bonnet hot harem of silk-skinned, saucer-eyed, shotgun-legged, classic reverse S-shaped, wild honey blondes, smoky brunettes, and firecracker reds, staring and smiling back at us, promising nothing more than a sweet moment's rush of blood, which somehow felt like forever, certain weightlessness in head and heart, and a rumpant hardness in our loins that made us feel invincible. After staring bruises into the pages and discussing with great passion which playmates we'd someday marry, while never once looking at each other, we neatly placed the holy mags back in chronological order, detumescing as we pilfered a few dollars in bright bicentennial quarters. The drummer pressed into them, reminding us of Dennis Wilson or Gene Krupa. For the coup de grace, we splashed on some spice, for it made us smell like men. Then we'd lock up the room and go down to D&L Deli to buy Italian hoagie, sun-kissed pops, and Topps baseball cards. Later, Poe would return to the room, count his quarters, find his Playboy stack ever so slightly disheveled, yell, "Jesus, cuckoo Christ," and place full blame on our boy Corey. Poe called him a fat, fart-fucking pig, shouting, "That kid's so ugly it hurts my feelings." A viciously hilarious stream of other jagged jewels followed. The boy has a mind like a sieve. He could go pound sand up his ass. His mama should have asked the doctor about the benefits of retroactive abortion. He was convinced Corey only used me and my brother for our family wealth. Our parents were house-proud thousandaires, after all. Pro proclaimed all of this in a crying holler voice only old men seem to have. Corey was consequently banished from the room during Poe's storytelling and bull sessions. Sometimes he'd throw on his army hat and show off his medals and weapons, delivering picaresque, often sordid narratives while consuming fantastic quantities of Ortlieb's beer, occasionally offering us secret sips until we were all half-assed and glassed over. Once he told us a story about Al Capone. He knew him personally. Said it wasn't the booze or syphilis from whores that blinded him, but rather his incessant masturbating that stole his sight. Being a Catholic school kid, I felt a pang of guilt, a cold grip of panic. Michael, ever the wise ass, said, ah, so that's why you wear those Coke bottles, Poe. I placed a moratorium on myself after that. No more of what the priests and nuns at school called manipulating one's genitals for little Willie C. Others saw through the con better than I, though. One time we caught our cousin Danny inside Poe's room. He had encircled himself with Playboy centerfolds and was masturbating into a five-and-dime Halloween mask of a wizened witch while screaming, free, free, over and over again. Another time the door to Poe's room was left ajar, I watched my grandfather sit on a bed dressed to the nines in his military best, replete with medals and epaulettes. He was clutching a framed photograph of a young, beautiful Grace, talking to her in soft, measured tones as tears streamed from his bloodshot eyes down onto the glass, making their tiny, honest sound. Poe died in that room, body shrunken by cancer. I was with him when he passed. We were watching a Jets Monday night football game. Wesley Walker had just scored a touchdown. I thought he was trying to high-five me, but he was just reaching for my arm, which he gripped and clung to, trying to rise. He said to me, I can see the exit light blinking. It's her eye after a joke. He laughed, and it seemed he was gone before finishing, his eyes fixed on something only he could now see. There was still light there, probably just slivers of gray shrapnel from the war he never lost, reflecting silver in the light off the TV. I closed them, switched off the TV, the darkness, the silence, saying all the things I couldn't and never would. He was buried with a decorated uniform, flag, guns, and a photograph of Grace. I still have one of his shirts. It was his favorite. It was bought with 6 proofs of purchase from Old Spice. An armada of cool mint green clipper ships sailing a placid white sea. Mother of pearl buttons and butterfly collar. Yellow crusty armpits, a faint scent of the man still on it, a ghost. I wore it just the other day to mixed reviews. The treasured Playboys were sold at a flea market. The cigarette coupons were redeemed for fanny packs and coolers. My mother still has the bicentennial quarters we didn't steal. And I still use Poe's one-liners religiously and take full credit. In fact, I just titled this piece after one. Enjoy responsibly, Poe.
Oh, pound sand up your ass.
Well, oh, that was my feeling.
That's a great story. That was a great poem, great story. Probably my favorite of the evening. I like the honesty, the truth, but I also like the humor. Like, you really get to know the person. I mean, not as well as you did, but the reader does. And I admire poems like that. So it brings us to the end of the show. And thanks for coming on again, man, on such short notice.
It was great to come on again. It was a pleasure rupturing your blog radio hymen the first time around, and this encore appearance, it was a time. I enjoyed it immensely. Long may you write, my friend, my fiend.
All right. I shall see you again in the virtual world and hopefully the real world down the line. Well, Will completely just hung up on me. Anyways. Yeah, so next week we have Amanda Joy, she remembers that the show's going on. She's out of Australia, so I guess when we do it on a Monday night, it'll be like Tuesday afternoon there. But and then that will be the last show again until January, because, you know, Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve, I'm not doing a show. So Amanda Joy, no show for 2 weeks, and then after that, we come back with Zarina Zabriskie out of San Francisco. Okay, what the fuck ever.